This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Meera Sivaso, the It's Our Doctor in the House series, and it happens to be our last live show for the year. In the studio with me, Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist, and we have two interesting topics we're going to be talking today. It's just the two of us today, George.
That's right. That means, very happy.
That means we can only talk about men's health.
That's right.
We can't talk about anything else health.
Well, I guess we can, but it's just like we won't have anybody in the expert position to comment on it, right?
Absolutely.
So it's been an interesting year, don't you think?
It 2019? Has been, George. Yeah. I mean, I've not done a lot of shows this year, but, you know, most of your shows, I think,
that's right.
Done.
I think, you know, I've been around enough despite turning 50 this year.
Yes.
And then it's been an exciting year. And, you know, did one marathon and barely survived it. And also, we had quite interesting shows, you know, in the past. I think probably one of the most memorable one I did was we held a huge conference, urological conference in Malaysia. And we had somebody called Declan Murphy. And then from Australia, and the other person, it's called Dasgupta, Prokar Dasgupta from Guy's in London, came over and analysed our data. And that was quite a kind of eye-opening show.
What was the data that they analysed?
It's essentially, you know, you always highlight it in Malaysia, there is a mandatory reporting system for cancer registry in the public sector.
Mm-hmm.
But in a private sector, we haven't got that. And then we've been trying very hard in order to get data, at least reflecting what's going on. And in conjunctions with Ministry of Health and also Ministry of Education in the universities, they managed to get data to show distributions of prostate cancer in Malaysia. And the interesting thing is that Prokar from London highlighted that our prevalence rate and also presentation, it's about 30 years behind UK, and how our data actually reflected a time capsule of what happened in the NHS 30 years ago. Because two-thirds of our men presented with prostate cancer actually presented late. So meaning that, you know, they've got prostate cancer, so it's not curable.
I think that's generally for cancer in general in Malaysia.
In Malaysia, that's right.
Most people are presenting at late stage.
That's correct.
But do we know why we are 30 years behind the UK?
Well, I would imagine it's probably because of awareness, you know, probably the knowledge that you have to wait until somebody is symptomatic before you are diagnosed with prostate cancer. Mm-hmm. I think fear, men who are quite scared of getting their blood tested for PSA are quite fearful, and then they're in denial and running away from it. And also one of the topics we're going to talk about today is that men presented younger and younger these days, and also we live longer and longer. And then the younger men assume that they'll never get prostate cancer, and then hit with such problems early on. And then also the older men who live longer assume that, you know, everything else seems to be okay. They worry more about the heart diseases and lungs, and seem to forget about the prostate is something that actually might be a time bomb.
Okay. I know you've mentioned this in the past, that most people die with prostate cancer and not of prostate cancer.
Correct, yeah.
So maybe that's why, George. I mean, it's a slow cancer.
Yeah.
It doesn't, you know, it almost feels like
correct.
It's a wait, watch and wait kind of a situation.
Correct, yeah.
Is that still the same?
It is the same. So therefore, the data reflected that these are the people who have got aggressive cancer. The aggressive cancer that actually are going to cause fatality.
Yeah. And what percentage of the population has this aggressive cancer?
Well, currently, Malaysia, prostate cancer is ranked number 4, and then it's increasing. An interesting thing, when we diagnose prostate cancer, we diagnose according to its aggressiveness in a scale. It's called Gleason scale. Mm-hmm. And then when we grade the cancer, the ones that you highlighted earlier, men who die with prostate cancer are low-grade cancer. And then when the Gleason score goes up, for example, it's scored between 2 to 10, if somebody who has got more than seven, then you're likely to run into problems with metastases within a period of 18 months. So those are the people who are presented in the Malaysian data, actually assuming that they're going to die with prostate cancer, tend to die of prostate cancer because they just have different type of cancer. So many of us in urology actually believe that prostate cancer itself, to group it all together as a cancer group, it's a wrong approach because they seem to be two different beasts. One is this kind of mild form which remain dormant for years and years and only activated due to whatever trigger that may arise. However, you may have these ones who are the beast, the real beast, tends to kind of become quite aggressive and get out of control before ones actually get treatment.
Okay. So the article we're discussing today is a study that was published in the journal Cancer in September. And they found that the incidence of prostate cancer in teens and young men is increasing in most countries. You know, when I read that, George, I thought to myself, in all the research of 10 years that I've been doing when it comes to men's health, that line belongs to testicular cancer.
That's correct, yeah. Wow, Mira. That's why they call you Dr. Mira.
No, I mean, testicular cancer affects the younger men.
Correct,
right?
Yes.
And,
yeah.
And but this study reports that the incidence of prostate cancer has increased in all groups between the ages of 15 and 40 years.
Yes.
And increased globally at a steady rate, averaging 2% per year since 1990 now. Mm-hmm. We're moving to 2020.
That's right.
That's a long time ago.
In a few days' time, we're moving to 2020.
But what's going on, George?
Yeah. I mean, truthfully, I mean, this sounded a little bit like scaremongering, obviously, you know, ranging from 17 to 40. In Malaysia, our youngest individual who were diagnosed was 37. All right, our oldest one, for whatever reason, was diagnosed at 102. Right?
Obviously, he did well.
He did very well. That's right. And the sad thing is, every time everyone looked at that data and said, why would you biopsy a man at 102? Let him be, right? Okay. Because at the age of 102, this cancer most likely is kind of like coherently lived together with the individual. But at the age of 37, I think one of the advancements these days is that of all these screening packages, when somebody actually gets screening and then and get a biopsy done because the PSA is slightly elevated, and also the new technology which we talked about in that particular show is that we're shifting away from the random biopsy. So classically, men will present with, let's say this 37-year-old individual is from Malaysia, presented with PSA of 12, which is three times higher than what it should be. In the past, most clinicians will say, don't worry, this is just an infection. Or cyclists will have a transient physiological rise of PSA. However,
and just to clarify, the PSA is the prostate-specific antigen test.
That's correct.
Which has a reputation of not being the best test.
Correct.
It is not persistent stress and anxiety
test
you call it.
That's right.
But you have a reason as to why you call the PSA test the persistent...
Correct. So if this individual at the age of 37 comes to my clinic, and then most of the time I would just say, do not worry, it's probably a little bit of infection causing this. And when we will manipulate the figures with antibiotics, medications for prostate.
What would have been the symptoms for this 37-year-old to come in?
There were two possibilities, either symptomatic or asymptomatic. The asymptomatic one is purely just go for screening and that's detected. Mm-hmm. And that's quite common. And what we do in the past will be just give antibiotics. If it doesn't settle, then we watch it. So that's kind of called surveillance, active surveillance. But in the last 2 years, the technology has allowed us to use very sensitive multi-sectional MRI scan to identify whereabout is the abnormal site, and from there you can target specific area of picking up prostate cancer. So with such strategy, you are including everybody, just assuming that everybody has got high PSA, would have, it's proven to be, it's prostate cancer until proven otherwise. And therefore, you're picking up more and more people at early stages.
Okay.
So that probably...
But why?
It's supposed to be the
older man's problem, not the younger man. I mean, isn't 15 a huge exaggeration?
15 is a huge exaggeration.
One in the world, maybe?
Well, possibly. It's probably the youngest in the world ever recorded, right? Okay, so let me clarify what prostate is. I mean, this is a part where we're probably just going to get, a lot of people calling in. And for those of you who are really interested to find out more about prostate, we're going to have a relaxing show today. Just talk a little bit about your PSA. We're going to get a huge number of people probably going to call in.
What better topic for the last show?
The last show, that's right. Why not? Since one show on urine, we had the show flooded with phone calls. Why don't you pick up the phone and call 7733 2900 or WhatsApp us on 018 78 9 8 9 9 or tweet us at BFM Radio.
That's right.
So let's come back to the story about this, PSA, what's wrong? The prostate itself actually has one sole function. It actually creates the secretions for sperm to swim in. Right. Okay. So that itself is has virtually no function beyond reproductive days, and because that secretion, it's the vast majority of the semen. It contains two components: the prostate itself, a secretory component where the liquid is excreted, and also muscular component in order to propel the semen forward. So you can imagine that if things go wrong, for example, the secretory part that goes wrong, then you will have something called adenoma, which is a vast majority of men at the age beyond 40 that will experience such problems. However, if the muscular side of things that goes wrong, for example, sarcoma, and then that itself can happen in prostate as well, although exceedingly rare, but cancer of the muscles can happen anywhere in the body. So I suspect this 15-year-old actually did not have secretory problems of the cancer, actually had the muscular problem of the cancer.
Okay, we have a phone call. Didi on the line. Hi, Didi, you have a question for us.
Afternoon, Didi.
Hi, good afternoon. How are you guys doing?
Very well, thank you.
Well, I was kind of interested about this topic that we're talking about.
Yep.
I have two questions. One question is there any other way than going through this chemotherapy and treatments from the hospitals to cure cancer? Is there any other way that we can do, such as diet and holistic way of curing cancer? Because I've heard a lot, you know. I've even heard like yoga can even, you know, help reduce the stress and, you know, making it stop multiplying and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Second question
is there anything that we can do to prevent from getting cancer, such as diet and food? Because I believe you are what you eat. I learned nutrition, so I kind of know like some food do trigger some cancer cells. So I would like to know what can we do to prevent this cancer thing.
Okay. Thank you very much, Dili. Yeah.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Yeah, okay. I'm going to answer the first question first. Obviously, as culturally in Asia, we would like to take something which is natural. We would like to use diet, grass, all sorts of things in order to help, because the neighbors told us that that cured certain cancers. Of course, I get patients who turn up to the clinic with Yutan grass and all sorts of things. I think, first of all, you need to understand what is the nature of the cancer. There are two types of cancers, the aggressive one, non-aggressive one, if, for example, for prostate cancer. If it's a non-aggressive one which you are watching, by all means, you can try all sorts of things that actually can bring up your immunity. Because essentially, the risk of cancer is triggered by something, and vast majority of time it's our immunity that suppresses the cancer. When the immunity is compromised, obviously the cancer will flare. In other words, what Didi is suggesting, the yoga, the diet, the holistic measures, if you built up your immunity, then if this is a low-grade cancer, by all means, that's the way to do it. If you have got high-grade cancer, and you choose to do that, regardless of whether it's breast cancer or prostate cancer, you're gambling your life, right? Because if you win, you might actually just get this time that you suppress the cancer. Because the cancer itself, unless it's excised from your body, should not be curable. If you lose, you lose your life. So I usually just lay this out to the sufferers. If an individual chooses to do this, if you do understand a yoga to cure cancer, if you bet on this and this is an aggressive cancer that actually obviously you placed a wrong bet, you may not be here next month.
But you're talking purely in the context of prostate cancer.
Correct.
Because the milder form is, non-aggressive form is
it stays dormant for many, many years.
It does not apply to any other cancer, really.
Correct. Well, I mean, there's certain other cancers, for example, renal cancer somehow has immunity correlations as well. Therefore, it's not responsive to chemotherapy or radiotherapy, and immunotherapy seems to be able to suppress it. So cancer, it's a curious entity that we don't fully understand. Mm-hmm. Answering the second question, of course, we would like to, we know non-communicable diseases like diabetes, obesity contribute towards cancer. And prostate cancer specifically, I wanted to answer your questions earlier on about younger men mm-hmm. tend to get cancer. It's because of lifestyle. Purely, it's the animal fat consumptions, low on fruit and vegetables. These are the risk factors that we know, in addition to genetic factors such as BRCA1 genes.
Okay, all right. And if you talk about prevention, George, is there any way you can prevent prostate cancer? Maybe don't grow old, perhaps?
I have a way. There is one way to prevent prostate cancer.
Which is?
Castration.
Oh, dear me, George, that's a bit extreme.
It is a bit extreme. So let me clarify this, right? Okay, I mean it. I know, like, the Klang Valley's listeners out there, all the men are kind of like squeezing their thighs because it's true. Prostate cancer...
I don't know why I am. Just at the word
castration. The word castrations, okay. Prostate cancer is one of those strange cancer that is fed by hormones. And the male testosterone is the culprit that feeds testosterone, feeds prostate cancer. So eunuchs who actually are castrated from younger age, or men who are born with bilateral non-functioning testicles, they don't develop prostate cancer. And men who has got metastatic prostate cancer, meaning that they presented with fourth stage prostate cancer, we actually just do castration for them, either chemical castration using medicine to destroy their testicular cells, or remove the testicular cell as a mean, testicles, just remove both testicles. And you should see, guys, you should see Mira's kind of like a face. She had jaw dropped to the floor.
Are you saying then that, you know, castration would fix prostate cancer?
Temporarily, yeah. For at least 18, from the Malaysian data. So we talked about two-thirds of men presented to Malaysian healthcare professions with metastatic late-stage prostate cancer. And they were either surgically castrated or medically castrated, and we managed to control the disease for an average of 18 months.
What about chemotherapy?
Chemotherapy is when they become castration resistant, meaning that despite the cessations of the hormonal suppressions, the cancer seems to flare up. And that is when immunotherapy, chemotherapy, and also something in the new pipeline of targeted therapy seems to be helping, right?
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yes. This is a reason why in the old days, when somebody presented, well, even now, in order to save costs, and then we do castrate men who presented with late-stage prostate cancer. I think that itself is enough reason for you to go and see a doctor, right? If you don't want to present late and don't want to be castrated.
But we're going to get everything. Man is going to grow old, George.
So what do you mean?
You can't stop
the balls,
that.
You don't want them anymore?
I mean, I'm just saying you can't really prevent it.
A few years ago...
One's going to go out and all of them get castrated, for goodness sake.
Sure, of course.
You know, you just talk about vasectomy and everyone thinks it's castration, you know, and nobody wants a vasectomy because of that.
That's correct. So, and this is real castration. This is not just a snip of the vas. A few years ago, two companies that produce these medication to shrink prostate by suppressing the active components of testosterone. And funnily, these are the drugs that are used for hair loss as well. So because male pattern baldness is controlled by testosterone, by taking these anti-testosterone medications, it seems to have an effect of chemo prevention, meaning that it will suppress the prevalence of prostate cancer in long run.
And your hair will grow?
your hair will grow. So you get hairy, and then you have less chance of getting prostate cancer.
This is a very interesting
conversation. It's very interesting, but you might not get the erection that you want. So there's no such thing as a free lunch. So there's always a payback somewhere.
We'll come back and find out. Well, just a reminder as to what castration is and the effects of it. And we'll go on to the next story, which is a testicle transplant that was carried out on a
Since
young
we're on
gentleman.
A line off.
Yes. to, you know, what happens if you don't, if you're born without testicles? Mm-hmm. What does that mean? And they've actually carried out a testicle transplant on this person. We'll come back and find out more up next. If you have a question, 0377332900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Good afternoon. It's our Doctor in the House series. Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist in the studio with me. It's our last show for the year.
And then we're talking about castration just to cheer everyone.
No, love. We're talking about men's health.
That's right.
Very much up George's alley. Everything to do with urology. We're focusing on the prostate and the testicle for some reason today.
No, since we didn't do a November, right?
Yes.
And then so we're kind of like playing catch up at the moment because, you know, I try to persuade you not to do it because I'm just too embarrassed that I didn't grow any moustache at all.
And I've told you why before.
Would actually know, right?
I didn't say that.
I know that. Every day I look to the mirror,
you
I know
see,
that.
My people have no issues with that.
I also know that.
Okay. Castration, what does that mean?
Okay, just chopping the balls off.
That's it.
That's it, yeah. Essentially, there are two ways that we will do it. I mean, surgical or medical. Medical essentially just use a injection that is done every monthly, 3 monthly, 6 monthly, and that will trick the brain to suppress the production of something called LH, which is a type of hormone. Obviously, for men who are holding on to their scrotal contents, and then they may choose to have that medical castration. Otherwise, we either surgically remove the content of the testicle or we remove both testicles.
Okay. So if men are getting prostate cancer at a younger age, do you have to change how or when you speak to your patients about screening? Do you tell them to... But then again, do young men come and even see you? Right?
Correct. Yeah. Well, young men come to see me when they... Well, I get naughty young men who had been...
Of course. So you need to catch them then.
That's right.
Not the
so
best
the
idea,
naughty
but...
men who claims that they're sitting on dirty toilet or dirty door handles.
Yes.
And then, you know what I mean. Mm. Wink, wink.
Yes.
And then essentially, they will have elevated prostate cancer marker, most likely due to, infections. And on other scenarios, cyclists, who will have elevated PSA physiologically, you have someone, if you just have very active sex life, then that will go up after ejaculation because that is a transient release of chemicals in your body.
Dispatch riders.
Dispatch riders, right?
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. So,
all those grab pain.
Food. That's right. So, we need to ask them. Obviously, occupational hazards.
It is.
And then, at the end of the day, if it's still persistently high, despite repeating it several times, these days we will do an MRI scan on them. Because just a random biopsy itself might not pick up what we want to know. And that itself begin to identify small area of cancer. And then that's probably what the journal that the article is reflecting, that increasingly we're picking up younger men. So in the past, disputing young men don't get prostate cancer, which is more or less what we've been telling people for years and years and years. But now... MRI scan may pick up that early cancer. Might not be a good thing because, as you know, sometimes picking up too many small, low-grade cancer might just over-treat people. For many, many decades in the States, any cancer equal to the big cut. But the big cut may not necessarily be the benefit because only low-grade cancer that can be watched and high-grade cancer can be removed in order to provide cure. So therefore, that opened up another Pandora's box for us to have that dilemma. Initially, we're having dilemma of the diagnosis. Now we're having the dilemma of when you get patients at young age presented with low-grade cancer, do they all have to have their prostate out? Because it will have a huge implications for young men. First of all,
I mean, world population.
Well, yes. Well, I mean, population, why we can make babies from test tube these days. So there's no question.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Yeah. So the there are two significant problems with these young men who are presented with early prostate cancer. Number one is that they can no longer ejaculate, because that ejaculatory mechanism has been removed.
Because you said it's muscular and it's secretory.
And secretory, yeah. Content. So there's no muscle, there's no secretions, there's no liquid coming out at all. And obviously that itself, to conceive naturally, is impossible. The second problem will be incontinent, because the prostate itself act as a gate in order to prevent leakage of urine. And third thing is that many men, with the operation that perhaps under one of the complications operation, is erectile dysfunction.
Oh, dear. Okay.
You know? So right. Imagine 37-year-old facing all those troubles. I think many men will run away from treatment.
So how then?
Death. Because aggressive prostate cancer,
yeah, if it's aggressive,
it's a fatality.
But you know, even if you watch and wait for younger men, how long can you watch and wait? I mean, for older men, I can understand.
Correct.
Right? You've lived your life. You've done a lot of things that you've wanted to do, but younger age.
Well, speak for yourself. I feel old, but I am old, but I feel I haven't done many
speak
things.
Speak for myself. I'm not a male.
Okay, all right. Speak for, well, I would, you know, because most of the time as clinician, you probably will, you have certain perceived, you have concept of how these men have lived their life, and then so it's enough, then there's no real reason to treat. I really think one of the ways when you handle any form of patients, we really need to, first of all, understand that patient's lifestyle. Because in order to perceive one 68-year-old man not really wanting to have another child or not really want to have any sexual activities, actually, it's a wrong perception. May not be the right perceptions all the time.
Okay. Yeah. Are you concerned? Is this an overreaction to an article?
I'm concerned that many men will be scared when they read articles like that. So you have more and more younger men to get tested and then subsequently get even more worried. I'm also concerned that when we picked up low-grade cancer in younger men, what do we do with them? Mm-hmm. Because over-treatment can induce in another demographic of patients.
What do you mean by over-treatment?
So, like what been done in the States, for example, every cancer just equals removal. And that itself may just over-treat men who may not end up with fatality as a result.
So remove the prostate in this case?
Correct, yeah.
A study also found that young American men with prostate cancer have worse survival rates. Why is that?
Yeah.
Why the American men?
Well, I assume the American men that they're referring to are men of the African-American origin, because we understand that genetically, the prognosis, it's very much dependent on that. So there's a huge element of genes that will determine their prognosis. So we know and understand that men of the African-American origin, if they're presented younger, they have worse prognosis.
Okay. Abdulaziz is asking, and this is a question that comes up over and over when it comes to prostate cancer, does the number of ejaculations or lack of it increase the chances of prostate cancer?
All right, okay. So what do you think, Mira?
How would I know?
Okay, right. This is when we're going to, this is when we're just going to get a lot of people phoning in and say, how many times? This is many times in neuroprotective. Indeed, there is a study that actually highlighted protective effect for ejaculation. But I'm going to tease the listener a little bit, because we're going to take a break and take that market update, because you need to tune in for the rest of the show to find
since
out.
Since when? You're really doing your job as a co-host now, aren't you? Okay, we'll come back.
Because that will get all the listeners interested and call in to give a number to say how many ejaculation is protective.
So is it protective?
Well, let's find out.
Oh, okay. Coming back after the market update on BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Mira Sivasuthi. It's our Doctor in the House series. Dr. George Lee, consultant neurologist, in for our last show for the year. And we're discussing prostate cancer.
And ejaculation.
Yes, and lots of it. It looks like we won't have time to do the testicle transplant. But, you know, very quickly. Okay, so we had a question about, you know, how many ejaculations.
That's right.
Is it preventive of prostate cancer or the lack of it?
That's right. Yeah. Okay, yeah. Let me clarify this study, right? This study was actually done in Massachusetts, and then it's by Harvard Medical School. Yep. Obviously, a very respectable institution. They monitored a healthcare profession. Admittedly, they were all Caucasian, white, male in these healthcare professions, ranging from doctors, physiotherapists, dentists, and then monitored something like 30,000 people from the 80s, 90s, 2000, and 2009. So a period of about three to four decades. An interesting thing is that the concept of asking them to jot down how many ejaculations by form of masturbations or penetrative for intercourse, and then compare 30 years down the line the risk of cancer in correlations with the number of ejaculations. For men who ejaculate less than 7 times per month have higher risk by 25% of getting prostate cancer.
What?
That's right. And then therefore, for men who ejaculate more than 21 times a month, actually are more protective in getting prostate cancer.
So less than 7 times.
That's
right. Is that even possible? You know, I think it's just
21 times. I'm kind of bring
forget
tears
the
to
seven
your eyes.
Because I'm sure that's
that's normal, is it?
More than the norm.
Seven per month. We're talking about per month here. We're not.
Yeah,
here.
But still.
On average, Malaysian populations more than 40 years old will be 6 times a month. More than 40 years old. Below 40 years old is more than 8 times a month, easily. Very active Malaysians.
Something
population.
Happens when you hit 40.
That's right.
What is it?
Yeah. Boredom, I guess. No, obviously, you know, the...
More than 21 times.
That's right.
And you're protected
what else do
by
they
how
do?
Much
yeah,
again?
You're 25% or so, yeah, of prostate cancer, risk of prostate cancer.
More than 21 times.
So guys,
times.
You know, so I'm not stating the...
Every day, la.
That's right.
Spread it out and just every day do something. And,
okay, this is not a hoax because of Christmas.
Well, but 25%.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
so it reduces your chance by 25%.
That's right. So what it's telling you? Well, the critiques of the study says that for men who are healthier, will have better sexual appetite and better sexual activities because they exercise more, they live healthier, and therefore they have less risk of cancer anyway. True, you know, if you actually look at it that way. But for the critics who actually are dwelling into it more, they actually worry that this prostate cancer perhaps is induced by some sort of infective material within the prostate itself. By evacuating that infective material, you might just reduce the risk of prostate cancer.
What is this infection?
Nobody knows. It's just like 30 years ago, you know, people would laugh when we say cervical cancer is caused by a virus, right? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, 30 years down the line, we have a vaccine for the virus to prevent people from getting cervical cancer. So therefore, you know, watch your space. Maybe 10 years down the line, if you and I are still doing this show, we might be reporting a data saying a particular pathogen has been identified to cause prostate cancer.
So... I'm still
You're
quite
still baffled
intrigued,
by
intrigued by the statistics of less than 7 times and more than 21 times.
You should, so you my should question, see Chase's face.
My next question is, how much of this actually contributes? There are other things, like you said, healthy diet,
indeed,
exercise and all of that.
I mean,
right?
But mind you, this is a study specifically done in order to look at correlations of ejaculation and prostate cancer. So somebody in the 80s and 90s obviously had a hunch to think that there is a correlations or protective effect of sexual activity and protecting from prostate cancer.
We need to do research as to what happens at the age of 40.
That's right. And it's also reflected by another study in Australia. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the study down under also proved the same thing.
Wow.
That's right. Admittedly, these are all, you know, like a young Caucasian men.
Do you think it'll be any different for the Asian man?
I don't think so. I really think that, you know, for somebody, I think there's some stories about, there's some truth about men who obviously are healthier, will have more frequent sexual activity. And that itself might just be the reason why, half of the reasons why men actually get less prostate cancer when they're more sexually active.
And given our NCDs, you really want to start looking after yourself at a younger age, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
If you say that also has a correlation amongst the younger people and prostate cancer.
That's right. So it's a good way to get men to be more healthy, I guess, or more active.
Give people a sharing there, you know. Frequency of ejaculation. We don't need to read those questions. All right, moving on. Do you think there are gaps in this research, George?
Of course, yeah.
In this rising incidence of prostate cancer amongst younger people?
I think so. Well, I think it needs to be highlight two issues. Number one, the genetic basis of that. I think for younger men to get this, there has to be a genetic basis of that. So I think reporting the BRCA genes background of these patients, it's crucially important.
Which it wasn't.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And then also the other part, which is the type of cancer. Like, for example, musculature cancer, like, for example, sarcoma itself can occur anytime, frequently in younger men, and then that component of prostate cancer is not exactly what we're talking about today.
Okay, fine. All right then. So that was very enlightening, I have to say. So I'm just going to quickly move on to the testicle transplant, where a 36-year-old man who was born without testicles received one transplanted testicle from his identical twin brother in a six-hour operation. Now, and they feel that this rare operation has implications for, you know, people like who are wounded soldiers, for an example, people who are accident victims, cancer patients. So what were your thoughts on that? I mean, it sounds, I mean, what are the ethical issues as far as a transplant like this is, you know, concerned? Okay. I mean, well, it's not life-saving.
It's not life-saving. Yeah, no. Because, first of all, transplanting anything between identical twins can be completely effortless. Apart from the technicality of getting the vessels itself working, identical twins, you do not need any immunosuppressions in order to get the graft to survive. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's the best way.
Half the battle won.
Correct, okay. Yeah. And then also longevity of the organ, the graft itself, can be sustained as long as it's being looked after. So that side, you know, put aside. That shows that the technicality of transferring an organ and then ensuring the vessels itself, integrity of vessels itself is fine. It's okay. Meaning that we have got microsurgical techniques that are able to join the three type of vessels, because there are three vessels that supply the testicle, testicular artery, the artery to the vas, and also cremasteric artery. And then, so that's fine. These are micro arteries. The issues about, I mean, I have men who presented with testicular cancer, and some of them two testicular cancers on the other side, because if you've got one testicular cancer on one side, you stand at about 20 to 30% chance, maybe 5 to 20% chance of the
other. So I'm assuming these are all younger men.
Correct,
right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So those men, apart from, because testicular functions, apart from producing testosterone, is for reproductive.
Yeah.
And if you store your sperm, testosterone can be given to you exogenously, meaning that we will inject you with testosterone. We can titrate it to whatever way that you want to look. If you want to be very butch and hairy, then we'll inject more testosterone. And if you feel like it's too much, then we can tail it down. So in a way, modern technology and modern medicine can supply the other role of testicle. So it's not necessary. However, for somebody obviously want to.
And this boy was born without testicles.
That's right. And then so you have to assume that if this was given to a wounded soldier, for example, somebody kindly donate their testicle to a wounded soldier, you have two issues. Number one is that your gametes, meaning that the sperm itself will be coming from a different person.
Yes.
So technically you'll be bearing someone else's child genetically. Right. The second issue
is that why they didn't connect the vas deferens for this patient?
Correct. Yes.
And the vas deferens, you want to just tell us it's not your neighbor, but by that name, vas deferens is the tubes.
The tube. That's the exact tube that
you tie during a vasectomy.
Correct. Yeah. Incidentally, we have one questions about vas deferens, right? Okay. somebody said, I want a vasectomy, but my doctor said that I'm too young and unmarried. It's very obviously judgmental,
yeah,
you know,
I
doctor
to
do that. Yeah, yeah, okay. And a vasectomy is a procedure that Malaysian doctors are not keen to perform. That's not true, because a vasectomy can easily be performed by urologists. Another question, if I get prostate cancer and have testicle castrated, I can still have erections and sex, right? And I will keep my testosterone. After castration, testosterone will disappear. However, a man should be able to continue to get erection if maybe a little bit compromised, but should be okay, because erectile functions itself is sustained by the blood vessels. So the blood vessels are not affected, but their libido will be affected because the testosterone will be significantly reduced. So they might have a little bit of compromised rigidity.
You know, George, I've always wondered, which is your biggest sex organ?
The brain.
Absolutely.
Yes.
So what does all of this matter?
That's right.
I mean, really?
Yes. For guys, it does matter, because your brain might be going haywire. But if you're diabetic, you have blood pressure, you have your cholesterol is completely off the chutes. No matter how much your brain is telling the vessels to open up to go to the your genitals, it's not happening. So therefore, keeping fit and healthy, your brain can continue to be that bigger sex organ in your body.
In our whole conversation, everything comes back to keeping yourself healthy.
Indeed. And our whole year and whole last... How many years have we been doing this?
11 years. That's going on 12.
That's right. Next year, 2020, will be 12 years of our conversation. It all comes back to prevention. It all comes back to essentially investing in your health, because none of these will be an issue if you invest in your health.
How often would someone be born without testicles? Is that rare?
Okay. Well, there are two types of people who are born without testicles. We get the hermaphrodites, meaning that somebody who has got mixed up of the XY genes, therefore they are either born with both gonads or no gonads at all. And that's quite rare. That's happened. It's like 1 in 300,000 or 400,000. However, men who are born with no testicles actually are born prematurely. At the gestation of 7 months, the testicle drop from inside the body into the scrotal sac, and then that happens at the age of 7 months. Technology allow children to be born earlier and earlier. So premature children are born with testicles that are stuck inside their body or stuck in inguinal canal. And that itself don't develop so well, because the testicles develop better in a lower temperature by 1 degree from your core body temperature.
Okay, but there's an operation to fix that? There's surgery that can be done?
Correct.
You don't necessarily need a transplant for
that. Don't. And then, however, if it remains in the body for a long time, like, for example, this chap who had the transplant, the testicle remained in his body for 35 years. Therefore, it will be useless, because the testicle itself actually has been maturing in a warm core bodily temperature. There's no need, there is no chance for that testicle to function to produce testosterone and gametes as required.
So that intervention needs to happen when they're very young. How young?
About less than 2 years old most of the time.
Okay.
And then most children born with inguinal hernia and undescended testicle are operated on earlier.
Okay.
If you reach puberty, it's too late.
And do you see a lot of these cases?
Of course, yeah. On a daily basis, we see kids with undescended testicle. It's one of the commonest urological presentations in baby checks. You know, the midwives will do baby checks, and then sometimes we're not sure whether the testicles have descended or not. And undescended testicle by far is one of the commonest presentation or condition we see.
This is a silly question, I'm sure, but does it descend at all after birth?
It will try with a bit of persuasions and then a bit of luck.
George, yes or no?
Not always. Because
it can happen.
It can happen. That tends to be something called retractile testicles, the testicle that is yo-yo between the body and the scrotum. And it's because the the spermatic cord is a little bit too short. However, when the children cry, when boys cry, the pressure in the abdomen tends to push the testicle down to a scrotal sac. So, you know, it maybe a little bit of, causing the child to be angry might just force the testicle to move down.
One benefit of having a crybaby, isn't it? Literally,
right.
For the boys. The benefits of a transplant like this from an identical twin, I mean, as you said, it's the easiest. Mm-hmm. There's least, issues with having to take immunosuppressants and mm-hmm. stuff like that. But, with the ethical issues, George, I mean, so these people know that they cannot have children then because of this reason.
Yes. And then, actually, because artificial reproductive technology, which essentially test tube baby, has advanced so much. And sometimes the remnant testicles, we can still find a little bit of sperms. And also, worst come to worst, effectively get donor sperms. And then, so reproductive site, technology can sort it out. And then the hormonal site, testosterone replacement can solve the problem.
But if you don't have a testicle, do you have sperm?
You don't. However, donor sperms can actually solve half the puzzle. So in a way, although we're pushing the frontier of science, in the last show of 2019, seeing something like this actually reflecting surgical technique has reached a stage where even microsurgery can transfer a testicle from another person's body to an individual as a recipient. I think that just highlighted that technically is doable, but is it necessary? I doubt it.
Okay. On that note, we've spoken about andropause in the past.
Yes.
That's male menopause.
Correct.
And we have spoken about hormone replacement therapy, which is testosterone replacement, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I remember you've always said that it was not the best idea.
Correct.
Why is that?
Well, testosterone is always perceived as the fountain of youth. Everyone wants testosterone because it makes you feel younger. It makes you feel like, you start getting zits again and then you start getting these drive, your energy level goes up, your musculature goes up, and most people want quick fix. In fact, you can actually bring it up if you exercise regularly, you drink plenty of water, you sleep adequately, and then your testosterone should really be sustaining it. To get it exogenously, it will shrink your testicles. And then because it tricks your brain, telling your brain that you have too much and your testicle will go into atrophy. First of all, you're dependent on this injection for life if you have got it for too long. The second problem is that we talked about prostate actually is feeding on testosterone. And we know excessive amount of testosterone in an uncontrolled manner will somehow get somebody who's at risk of prostate cancer to get it out of control, hence getting prostate cancer. So those are the two big risks. And then so if you actually have it long term, then you need to consider two consequences. One is the risk of prostate cancer. The other one is potential risk of you may never get your testicles or testicular function back anymore.
It's amazing how your hormones can, they're a double-edged sword, actually.
Indeed. And it's the same
for females as well.
As well, that's right. So therefore, we started the show saying there is no free lunch. So what it comes down to is just there's no shortcut. Be healthy, exercise, sleep well, no stress, eat fruit and vegetables, and be happy.
Hug love.
Hug love. It's Christmas. Hug the next person, the guy next to you or the woman next to you.
Yes, Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
Likewise. And to all the listeners out there as well.
Yes, and we'll see you back in 2020. Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist in our last Doctor in the House series for 2019 on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my. Or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.